Hi, James.
Hi, Will. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. I mean, it's almost Christmas. You know,
it is.
It's the happiest time
Merry
of year.
Merry impending Christmas.
Merry impending. It is Christmas Eve. Where are you in California? You sent me an obnoxious email that said it was you had a jet. You know, too warm for a jacket or something.
Yes, I've got my sleeves rolled up. The sun is shining. Mm-hmm. It's just another beautiful day in California. How's Iowa?
We are having an ice storm. So hopefully we'll be able to get out of here tomorrow morning. We're going to Connecticut to see Carrie's parents and extended family.
Travel safely.
We'll try. We'll try our best. We've got to drive to Moline, one of the Quad Cities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what have you been doing lately? James, have you been going to see any movies?
You know, it's hard to see movies with a six-month-old baby. That said, mm-hmm. we saw about three-quarters of Twilight, New Moon. Mm-hmm. We had to run out at the end, so we missed mm-hmm. the rousing, climactic 30 extra minutes of movie. But mm-hmm. one film that I'm really excited about not seeing is Avatar, because having read all the commentary, as I'm sure you've done too, there's really just no need to see it anymore, right?
Yeah. That is also a movie that I've enjoyed not seeing as well. You know, James, I've been totally derelict in my duty to introduce us, so I suppose we should do that even belatedly. So I'm Will Wilkinson of the Cato Institute, and you are James Paulos. And I'm not sure what all your things are. You blog for Postmodern Conservatism at First Things. What else are you doing, James?
Yeah, Pomocon is the shingle. You can occasionally still find me at the American Scene when the spirit moves me. All my other projects are so secret that they can't even be mentioned on National Blogging Heads TV.
All right. Well, good luck to you.
I'm a grad student at Georgetown, working slowly on a dissertation.
Well, I look forward to greeting you as Dr. Paulo someday soon.
I'm sure the rest of the world is waiting with bated breath.
Okay, but let's talk about not seeing Avatar. What have you heard about it?
I've heard that that the blue people look like tabby cats in their coloration. I've heard
tabby cats?
That sort of a brushed, sort of orange, stripey effect on their otherwise blue faces.
Because I've never seen a blue tabby cat, but it's the pattern on their body that's reminiscent of a cute house cat.
Yeah, I mean, I think they look more like snorks than smurfs, but I think that's just me.
Definitely more snork.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, snorks with guns.
Mm-hmm.
It seems
Do
to
they
be
have
more
guns?
Guns shooting at snorks than snorks bearing arms. I think they bear trees.
Yeah, they speak to the forest. I understand.
Yes. When you stare into the forest, the forest stares back.
Yeah. So what's the plot? The plot is that there is this planet, like the forest planet of Endor, but it's called Pandora, and it has some sort of incredibly valuable substance called unobtainium. Nice.
Yes, it's almost unobtainable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
but apparently
it
is obtainable with guns.
Yes. As anything is, really. Especially peace, as Barack Obama reminded us at his Nobel Prize acceptance lecture.
Yes. A very prudently chosen number of guns.
Yes, but that's beside the point. So there's this planet that has this thing. There are these snork-like blue people who speak to the forest. Who are in the way, and so the sort of imperial U.S. military-like forces descend to destroy these innocent, forest creatures in order to get their oil or whatever it is. And that's bad, because greed is bad, and raping the earth is bad, and being in touch with the forest is good. And so the plot is that one guy who's like who's like a space marine who got crippled, he somehow becomes one of the snork people, and, you know, becomes their leader and switches sides and fights against his own, you know, troop, you know, because he is he's gone native or something like that. It sounds amazing.
Well, yes. What could be more amazing than discovering that just when you think you're going to be sort of wheelchair-bound ex-Marine, you can actually sort of control this hybrid being that can frolic in the forest and have what apparently is not particularly hot cross-species love. This seems to be one of the big disappointments of the film as far as people who would otherwise love the film are concerned. The concern is that the you know, it's sort of like the charge that was leveled against the Matrix series, which is here's this opportunity to have hot Matrix sex, and in fact the sex wasn't very hot at all. There's that awkward jungle, as in sort of not quite house music, but some other kind of dancey music scene, and that was not very fulfilling, at least not for me, and apparently not for a lot of other people. Same sort of charges being leveled against the love scene here in this film.
Yeah, I mean, it really does seem to be the great promise of CGI to give us better, you know, it just extends our ability to depict our fantasies, you know, almost, you know, without limit. And it's disappointing to hear that it was not hot.
Well, it seems CGI obvious sex. That if this was a Japanese film, all of those problems would be gone. But I do think that it sort of, if I can caram this observation off onto something of a more substantive, critical point. Raihan in his Forbes, column on the film, made the point that here are these, astounding extraterrestrials who are, you know, fit of body and huge of eyeball and generally super exciting beings, right? But it turns out that they're really, really boring, and even to the point of being sanctimoniously boring about maintaining the integrity of the natural world. And there's this sort of rote piety that comes along with the anti-military but pro-nature, pro sort of pantheistic. Harmonious living side of the cosmic ledger that seems to me to strike some sort of weird similarity with the way in which here you have what would seem to be an opportunity for really genre busting and film historical cross species lovemaking, right? And I'm not just saying this to be cute, right? I mean, you know,
it's always coming back to the
CGI opportunities, right? And it could be a scene that is that carries some sort of human force that really resonates with who we are as people and what it means to be a person. And it's just not there. You know, in the same way, you have these amazing otherworldly creatures who turn out to be, aside from the fact that, you know, their skin glows in visually appealing ways. Bores.
Yeah, so it's one is a, I've heard it's kind of one of those movies that if you've got a certain kind of sensibility, you end up you know, rooting for the villains because the good guys end up being just so their, you know, their Rousseauian noble savageness is, you know, so anodyne in the end that you kind of start rooting for the, you know, the planet rapers because at least they're, you know, making something of themselves, you know?
Well, I mean, this is how you get from Rousseau to Marx, right? You have Rousseau who harkens back to the noble savage, but the noble savage is also a dull, you know, there's a subhuman quality to the noble savage. And by the time you sort of fast forward through the 19th century, you wind up with a guy like Marx who says, oh, yes, you know, capitalism, horrible, horrible, devastating. But also this stage of human development that unleashed all this great creative potential, and it's, you know, it's sort of a necessary step on the path to salvation for all. And I think, you know, again, you get a bit of this, or you seem to, I have to say, since I haven't studied the film myself firsthand, you seem to get the same sort of narrative where, you know, yes, science has to be developed in a way or will develop inevitably in a way that poses this existential threat to the purity of the natural world. But the answer isn't eliminate science. The answer is redirect science, to enslave science to the right kind of ideology about tuning our hearts back into to nature, and listening to nature and listening to our hearts. In that way, science will be sort of converted into a tool for good rather than for evil, and progress can be redeemed. I personally, if that's the message that you want to deliver, I think you can look to the end credit sequence in WALL-E. And there it is, done mm-hmm. about as well as it could be done. And beautifully, too, and in a very human way, a way that doesn't need sort of extra species. Robots, yes, but not humanoids that aren't human.
Well, that was wonderful, James. I think we've done about as much profound analysis of a movie that we haven't seen as is tolerable. So let's move on. Let's talk about Tiger Woods' philandering.
Well, how do you feel about that?
I've been to that movie. I've got a TV. I've looked at it, and I've heard a bit about Tiger Woods' sexting ways.
Well, I guess my quick take on Tiger is there was a David Brooks column from a while back where he was writing about genius, and he wasn't writing about genius in the way that, say, John Stuart Mill wrote about genius, where he says some people are just more individualistic, or are individuals more so than other people, right? So everyone's an individual, but some of us are more individual-ish or individual-y mm-hmm. than others.
I'm sorry to have interrupted. I just said I think individually is the way to say it.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Brooks comes along and says, actually, genius is like Mozart practicing for 10,000 hours. And once you get those 10,000 hours under your belt, then you have this sort of expert competence that allows you to run wild with your creativity. While still structuring it so as to produce genius. It seems to me that if that's the model of genius or exceptional individuality that we like to work with, and it seems like that it is because we live in a society where specificity is rewarded and expertise is prized and respected, and Tiger Woods is sort of the poster boy for competition theater. Right, where men, put down the sword and pick up a golf club, and you can distinguish yourself by mastering this sort of challenging puzzle environment provided by golf courses, along with sort of other men who have engaged in a sort of devotional discipline built around the solving of those kinds of complicated courses. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be inadequate to whatever it is within Tiger Woods, that makes him struggle and strain for whatever it is that he wants.
Yeah. You can win as many Masters as you want, but like an ego won't get you off, right? I mean, like I think part of it is that did you read that? I recently, Andrew Sullivan is doing his annual ridiculous awards, and one of the awards was the Van Hoffman Award for egregiously bad predictions. And one of the nominees is our exalted host, Bob Wright, who wrote a piece in Slate way back in the 90s, talking about Tiger Woods and right. Talking about his father had made these incredible claims about Tiger having sort of messianic qualities because he contains a multitude of human types within him, being Kablan Asian. And I think, he's one of those guys who grew up in this sort of like hot box atmosphere where you're forced to train over and over and over and over again. And I think a nice example of that, recently I saw read an excerpt from Andre Agassi's biography, which looks fascinating. And, you know, he was talking about how basically, he didn't have a childhood. He went to this, Nick Bollettieri's tennis camp where he had to, eat, sleep, and, tennis all the time. And it's just too structured. And you need something outside of that. But the fact that you keep winning, or the fact that you're so good, makes you feel trapped. The fact that you're the best makes it, even if you start to hate what you're doing, you can't just give it up. And so you need some kind of outlet. And I think somebody like Tiger, who not only has this, had that kind of childhood where he was sort of carefully cultivated to be the best, that he, in addition to that, he had these sort of like messianic expectations heaped on him by his crazy parents. It feels like in order to get out from under that, you probably needed to, get on top of some, skanks. And then that's what he did.
Well, I mean, there is a manner in which it seems that the creation of this artificially perfect, ordered world that you live in as a professional on a constantly regimented basis contributes to some kind of felt need for a parallel realm in which utter chaos can reign. Obviously he got to a point where he felt the need to try to manage that chaos in some sort of damage control way. But there's got to be some sort of perverse delight in toggling back and forth between this highly ritualized professional world and very public world, and then this completely disordered private world, and not just disordered in sort of the way that a natural law theorist would want to use the word disordered, but clearly Tiger was in over his head here, and honestly, who wouldn't be? And when the numbers start to rise in the way that they did in Tiger's case, you've really got to ask how much sense it makes, or how sound the judgment is, when corporations latch onto his sort of highly regimented perfection and hold it up as a model of sort of what it is that they're trying to sell to people in the way that Accenture did.
Yeah.
After all, what does it mean to be a tiger?
A rower.
Not what's on the billboard.
No, I mean, I kind of hope he finds the whole thing kind of a little bit relieving, that puncturing your own mythos has to, I don't know. You either would be incredibly panicked, or you would just feel a sense of liberation that you don't have to live up to these crazy expectations anymore.
Well, we live in a world in which, there are a few outlets for confession, and there are very few outlets for confession that isn't just totally public. It's not like you can let the air out of the balloon slowly these days. Either you've got a priest somewhere who you can confess to, or you've got a spouse who you really love and trust, or you've got, TV and TMZ and the internet.
Messianic potential, who are you supposed to, confess to?
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. Like, who does Jesus talk to about his problems?
And after all, what is Tiger going to save us from?
Mm-hmm.
What was he going to save us from? Inefficiency?
That's an excellent
motivation
question.
I don't know. Maybe loss of motivation.
I think Tiger shows us that when we blend together the various types of humankind, that is when we finally achieve perfection. I think that was Tiger's lesson. But now he's falling.
A point that James Cameron would no doubt endorse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about something a little more substantive, if possible, than James Cameron movies and a philandering golfer. Let's talk about healthcare reform. It looks like it's going to pass tomorrow. on a Christmas Eve vote. What do you make of this this business?
Oh, what a dreary business it is. This is not a good bill. You know it's a bad bill when even the people that are desperate to pass the bill start out their talking points by rolling out a point that emphasizes how bad the bill is, right? Mm-hmm. It's not the bill we wanted, but it's really important that we pass it anyway for this host of other considerations that we've tacked on to the bill. So that's sort of troubling indicator number one. Troubling indicator number two, though, and this sort of hits me where it hurts as a political theorist, is and this was Harry Reid a couple of days ago, or a clip from a couple of days ago that might have been from, you know, any point during this long, interminable horribleness that is the pseudo healthcare debate that's taking place on the actual floor of the Congress where real debates once took place. The point that he underscored, as dramatically as Harry Reid can underscore anything, is, you know, this isn't about, you know, fiscal responsibility. This isn't about good governance. Damn it, this is about human suffering, right?
Mm-hmm.
People are dying out there. And even if they're not dying out there, well, they're going to die out there this year or next year. And, you know, where will you be when that person dies one day because of something that you could have prevented?
Or, if only or in 2013 when the bill actually goes into effect.
Yes, that's right, right? And so this is the timeline on this thing is a whole other sort of insane question. And for every, you know, every gonzo provision that's been secretly packaged into this bill, like, you know, it's like they're sewing heroin into the lining of their jackets, right? And I think Megan McArdle touched on this in one of her recent posts on the matter, where they're sort of slipping this provision in that says, oh, you know, this law isn't like other laws because it's you can't repeal it and you can't mess with it. We're just going to build it into the law that once Congress passes it, it's basically a super duper law, right? In the way that Roe versus Wade is super duper precedent. It's not real precedent. Yeah. It's something bigger and better. It's uber precedent. So that's
so insane. In particular, that provision is for some panel, some kind of cost control panel that because part of the problem with the bill is that it's clearly got really no mechanism for bringing costs under control, even though that was one of the main one of the main motivations for healthcare reform was that, you know, ballooning cost of healthcare. Well, it's got nothing in it that really helps make the prices of various procedures go down or holds you know, excessive spending in check. So they want to have this board that that kind of looks things over, and they want its decisions to be binding in a way that can't just be reversed later on. So they're trying to figure out some way of having, you know, being able to credibly commit to the kinds of reforms that you would need in order to have adequate cost control. But it does end up being in that kind of silly, you know, here's our super duper law. We're going to make a rule that nobody can change in the future, which probably isn't constitutional.
And of course, in order to figure out or in order to prove that it's unconstitutional, we need to spend, you know, God knows how many months or years kicking that up the chain. And, you know, by then, you know, we might have, well, I think I'm safe in saying we definitely will have a different court by the time it gets up there. So net-net, are you against the bill? Do you think it's going to – how big of a debacle do you think it's going to be? Is there any way out of this mess?
I'm not sure. I think it's a pretty big debacle. I'm against it. If I can back up a second, here's what I've been disturbed by the whole process all along, the way I see the battle shaping up or the way it's gone, there's a kind of urgency in the issue of healthcare reform that's not in other issues. And I think the urgency comes from the fact that many people on the left, many people in the middle, see access to healthcare as a fundamental human right. But our system, the political system, doesn't have any guarantee in it and that bothers them. That we need to have a built-in guarantee that makes sure that people have access to health care, and that is that's the last piece of the puzzle. That's the capstone on the second Bill of Rights that was, you know, that started to be written under FDR. And it's been elusive all these years. We've never gotten this final piece of the second Bill of Rights in place. And there's something about thinking of it that way, that when you're thinking about it as, you know, that here's a fundamental basic human right, and it's just kind of an unfortunate fact of history that the United States Constitution was written in the 18th century rather than the 20th century. So it didn't include a entitlement to health care in it. And that's something we need to change. And when you think of something as a fundamental right like that, you don't think it ought to be on the table, right? Like the point of rights is that they are the things you take off the table of democratic deliberation, right? We don't debate whether or not we're going to be able to censor newspapers, right? That's off the table. And if you think of healthcare as a right, you think it ought to be off the table, but it's not. And that's really infuriating. But it is on the table, right? So what happens, I think, is that very motivated people, you know, well-meaning people on the left have the sense that they need to jam something through no matter how bad in order to create the foundation upon which a real guarantee can be established. And this is really urgent because it would be incredible. I mean, it's like we don't have a First Amendment. It's like we don't have a Fourth Amendment. It's like something that has to be there. And if you have to make a huge number of compromises in order to, you know, at least to get your foot in the door, get a foundation upon which you can build, then you got to do it. And I kind of understand that. That makes sense. But at the same time, it's also sort of infuriating because
when the foundation is the state of North Dakota and everyone else has to sort of pivot from there.
Right. So there's something about, I think, the dialectic where the democratic process that we've seen is a complete travesty. It's just a travesty. I mean, the fact that this is a huge fundamental change to the set of rules people, you know, will live their lives under. And it's embodied in a, you know, thousand some page document that literally the deliberative body won't be able to read. Right? That strikes me as an outrage. I see the point of it if you think that this is something that's incredibly urgent and just needs to get done no matter what. So I think there's something interesting about how you prioritize the values of liberal democratic deliberation as opposed to what you think of as the entitlement, the human right to access to healthcare. And I think these things are in conflict. And so part of what has me upset is that I actually do feel like this kind of legislation is a change in the basic structure of our society, and that it is something that really does affect us at, you know, implicitly the constitutional level. And it's the sort of thing that should get the kind of deliberation that a change in the Constitution should get. In that sense, I have no problem with the supermajority, you know, convention in the Senate. But I feel like we're not getting any deliberation at all. And part of the point is that it's too important to deliberate about because you can't trust Americans to get behind the rights that they have. Right? They won't endorse an institution that will protect their human rights. So you can't just leave it up to people. You have to jam it through. And there's something that grates really badly, you know, about that.
Well, I'm tempted to go in a couple different directions here, but in the interest of imposing discipline upon myself, I want to push on the fundamental right question because mm-hmm. it seems like a fundamental right to health care could actually be a right to health care that's fundamental in virtue of something else that's deeper or prior to it. Or it could cash out in two ways. Example one. We need this right to healthcare to be embodied in some deeply rooted way in our social compact or in our legislation, because it's impossible to pursue or to realize happiness without these kinds of some set of minimal guarantees when it comes to healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Example two, a different story. We need to guarantee this bundle of standards when it comes to healthcare, because human beings, at least Americans, have a fundamental right to be free of certain types of suffering. So there are two possible motivations here. One which says, our healthcare system is broken. We need to fix it in some way. It seems like the only way that we can start to fix it is by going down this road. But why should we do this at all? Well, it's because for too many Americans, possibly me or you, if you're thinking in Rawlsian terms, our ability to be happy is materially impeded by the current state of our healthcare coverage. It appears, if the polls are right, that a majority of Americans, or at least some significant number of Americans, are fine with whatever they've got. But also it seems like informed opinion is in agreement that what we've got doesn't really work that well. And so even if you like what you've got, you might want to think twice about whether or not what you've got has any sort of reliability to it. So that's one possible way of approaching the issue. But the way that not just Harry Reid, but I think the left in general is approaching the issue is to sort of take the way of expressing this that Judith Schlar has taken. Cruelty is the worst thing we do in a small L liberal society. The task of politics is to minimize cruelty, to stamp it out wherever we find it, and beyond that, not just to sort of turn back affirmative acts of cruelty, but to whack away also at sort of passive. Passive examples of suffering. So even if no individual is specifically being cruel to this person or this group of people, if they're suffering, well, gosh darn it, what is liberalism if not the concerted effort to use politics to eliminate suffering wherever and whenever is possible? It seems to me that it's this concern that is driving the language of fundamental rights here. That people on the left would even possibly be willing to concede that healthcare as such isn't a fundamental right, but damn it, people are suffering, and so given sort of who we are as Americans and the sort of who we are as small liberals, if politics can't eliminate suffering on this sort of social scale, then what is politics for, right? One answer might be to prevent bills that are this dysfunctional from being hardwired into our system of governance, right? But that's a conversation that isn't really happening in the way that I think it needs to be happening for us to get the right kind of perspective on the seriousness of this whole exchange.
A lot of fascinating points, James. I'm glad you brought up Judith Schlar's idea of a liberalism of fear, which is a phenomenal essay. I encourage everybody to go read it. As you say, what she says in there is that the fundamental aim of liberalism in this strand of liberalism is to stamp out sort of needless cruelty, needless suffering. And she contrasts the liberalism of fear to the liberalism of rights. Which is, a Lockean view that sees people as having a certain kind of natural rights that establishes a kind of normative order that's independent and prior to government. And I think that's a lot of libertarians are that kind of liberal. And she contrasts that and also with, you know, liberal perfectionism, which is which I think is maybe probably the dominant view in terms of like why something like healthcare is a right. The liberal perfectionist perfectionism is a funny term, but the idea is that the point of a liberal society is to ensure that everybody has the opportunity and resources to, you know, cultivate their genuine character and bring to fruition all of their potentiality, right? To perfect themselves in this kind of way. And that people have no real serious prospect of realizing their potential or cultivating basic human capacities if they are suffering from an illness or are find themselves in terrible financial straits because of some kind of accident. And so this is
Sen and Nussbaum, and so you can trace it back to Mill and so on.
Yeah. So the liberalism of fear, which Richard Rorty picks up on later, when he's trying to be a liberal, he says that's what it's about. It's just about reducing suffering. The interesting thing, if you look at the Sklar essay, is that she's very, very concerned in a way that I'm very sympathetic to, with inequalities in political power. And she's really concerned with the cruelty that's inflicted by the state. And she's very much in line with somebody like George Kateb in this sort of sense that she understands, I don't think it's just a conjecture, that basically the worst things that ever happen are things the governments do. And in particular, the police, the military, they torture, they murder, and people are crushed, the people who do the worst under regimes in which the government and the state are highly empowered are the least well off. And one of the things that troubles me so much about the healthcare bill, to bring this back around, is that it really does seem like an official endorsement of a certain kind of corporatism. It's creating an official cartel among all these insurance companies that is exactly what you would not do if you were trying to prevent systemic inequalities in political power. That kind of cartelization is what happens when government is being co-opted to serve the interests of a few large private industries, and the people who benefit most from that generally aren't the least well-off people. So I'm sure there are lots of people who will benefit from the extension of insurance, but the way that it's actually finally being done is ought to be worrying. And I should emphasize, it really is worrying to lots of people on the left, your Matt Taibbis, your Jane Hampshire, Marcos Melitzis, that type of person. A lot of people are worried about the corporatist elements in the healthcare bill. And the idea that we have to pass whatever, because we need to stamp out the needless suffering that's caused by people having a lack of insurance, I think is really short-sighted. So I think that's how I come down on it, that there's a kind of myopia here that is doing more to empower sort of corporate and government elites in a way that tends to end up badly for the poor than is being done to help the poor.
Well, yeah, I think that's about 99% absolutely right. Not going to be many fireworks or sparks flying in terms of this portion of the quote unquote debate here.
Yeah.
But Tim Carney has been putting his thumb on this nerve for a while too, where big business and big government are sort of shaking hands, and the rest of us are picking up the tab. Mm-hmm. This is as far as that point goes, I think a terrible black eye for Obama and for any Democrat that's trying to push this legislation through. When you look at the cartelization of the healthcare industry, it's just abominable. People who are interested in anything resembling a human touch whether on a social or an individual level, have got to be deeply concerned by what's going on. So yes, I think that point's quite right. I wouldn't want to be so sensational as to cry fascism here, because obviously, you know, when you sort of go back to, we don't want to pull up Orwell and talk about fascism in an Orwellian context. This, as bad as the government mandating that cartelized healthcare monopolies make customers of every American they can find, as bad as that is, it's definitely not a boot stamping on the human face forever, right? So this is some sort of anti-fascism that still carries the sort of horrible government corporate partnership that I think you do see as a matter of fact in fascistic regimes. You know, that's sort of the whole point, is you muster private power and you muster public power, and when the twain shall meet, then you can solve all kinds of huge problems in huge ways. Of course, I think, as you and I would both agree, actually you'd be creating even huger problems. And that's regrettable. Go ahead.
Okay. I was just going to say one of the points that I think, Sklar made, forcefully and well, is that, in the liberalism of fear, there's a very pragmatic anti-utopian streak to it. And one of the things that you really want in your system of institutions are lots of distributed power centers that can check one another. And in that sense, it's very healthy to have a strong business sector, a strong government in some sense, a strong union movement, a strong sort of active civil society, where you have all these various interests who can coordinate and act independently to check one another. When you get these fusions, when government functions and private functions fuse in these sort of cartels or oligopolies, you lose that kind of check, right? When the interests of the private health insurers becomes entwined with the agendas of one of the major political parties, or when the interests of I don't mean to be partisan, the interests of military contractors and weapons manufacturers become inextricably tied to one of the parties, you lose that kind of separation of powers and checks that you need in order to keep the force that government has at its disposal in check. So this kind of thing that is troubling in a very large institutional sense. I have no idea actually how it's going to pan out. So I don't predict that terrible things will happen. But I think it's part of a trend. And I think I find myself just agreeing wholeheartedly with a lot of progressives, in the bailouts, in the nationalizing General Motors, nationalizing insurance companies. The whole approach to all of the problems that the U.S. faces right now seems to be this rush to the fusion of government and private enterprise in a way that has historically, not only been inefficient, but has been dangerous. And so I don't want to make any, dire or hyperbolic predictions about what will come to pass, but I find that whole trend objectionable and worrying. And I don't think that the liberal advocates of the current legislation have been as worried as maybe they ought to be. And I know that somebody on Daily Coast made the observation that a lot of the Democrats who are very strong advocates of the current legislation were also strong advocates of the invasion of Iraq. Not that there's any sort of logical connection between those questions, but perhaps there's a connection in the kind of an affinity in the psychology behind them, of the real politic psychology behind it that accounts for that strange pattern.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there is something of a logical affinity there to put my paleocon hat on for a second. In the case of Iraq, right, it really did us a disservice. Or the Iraqi regime did us a disservice by lying to Saddam on a regular basis, as the Foreign Affairs article that came out, I guess, a couple of years now ago, demonstrated, right, Saddam, so how's our weapons of mass destruction program going? Oh, wonderful, wonderful. You know, everyone's sort of nervously looking around the table, knowing that there is no weapons of mass destruction program, right? So, of course, our ability to sort of read Iraq's signals was badly distorted and led to a lot of decision-making and sort of collective decision-making that wouldn't have happened otherwise. But the point remains that the rhetoric of crisis is what drove that debate. The rhetoric of crisis that says we have a problem right now, and it's so real and it's so bad that we don't have the luxury of running our sort of prudential calculus about what our response might be. And in fact, anyone who wants to try and put the brakes on the train, right, and say, well, you know, this might be a serious problem, but at least let's spend some time to sort of think through whether or not this possible response is the right one, or is the best one, or is even a good one at all, right, that mm-hmm. might have disadvantages that will so systemically outweigh the advantages that maybe we'd be better off, at least for this, you know, for this 2-week period of time, or this month, or even this, you know, legislative session, do nothing. That didn't happen with Iraq. It's not happening with healthcare. Alan Wolfe, in his recent book, The Future of Liberalism, made quite the point of condemning the Bush right in as strong of terms as he could muster while still being sort of reasonably polite in an academic sense, condemning them for mobilizing that kind of rhetoric and for saying, in a national security sense, we live in a world of permanent crisis. We live in a world of the exception. You know, he drags in Carl Schmitt and says, oh, Bush is this great Schmittian. Not really. But the narrow point, which is that the rhetoric of permanent crisis creates a sort of therapeutic politics where the decision makers become the people who enable the sort of populace to cope with this crisis, right? The crisis can never be cured. The problem will never go away. It's only something that can be coped with. And the only way that we can cope with it effectively is by allowing our experts to sort of administer the right kind of policy medicine. And it's going to be harsh, and it's going to be fast, and we don't get to know how it's going to pan out, right? It's like it's like getting the shot of morphine, or it's like getting the paddles. It's a shot of electricity. There's no time to question what logic might spin out from that sort of action.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same thing's happening on the left here with healthcare. But you know, instead of national security being the perpetual crisis, the state of perpetual crisis, it's human suffering in a way that transcends, as you suggested, the whole question of rights in a way, right? Mm-hmm. What's a fundamental right and what isn't is sort of a secondary concern to whether or not there are people right now who are hurting. And, you know, if Bush deserves to be to be fingered for any particular kind of excess in this respect, it's got to be the fateful line that he uttered when Katrina was sort of had been going on for too long already, and oh, when people hurt, government's got to move. It's that sentiment which, as understandable as it might be in a moral context,
mm-hmm.
because after all, you know, just because it's not a tort to stand by and watch someone drown, right? Doesn't mean that you wouldn't be a better person if you tried to help them in at least some way, right?
Mm-hmm.
As understandable as that impulse or that sentiment or that fellow feeling might be, when that feeling renders political decisions and policy programs right or wrong, acceptable or unacceptable, regardless of the cost they impose, regardless of the effects that they have either today or tomorrow on the very way that we do politics and the very possibilities of policymaking,
mm-hmm.
well, you know, that's just somewhere that I don't want to go, and I don't think anyone mm-hmm. should really want to go.
Yeah, let me dig in a little bit further to this idea because I think the idea behind the necessity of, I mean, so when I hear the boosters of the current legislation, then, you know, there's a lot of things missing that they would like, but there is, it's still, it's a good bill. It's going to extend the number of people, expand coverage. A lot of people who weren't covered before are going to be covered now. It puts an end to certain kinds of you know, what people think of as unjust practices in the insurance industry. You can't be disqualified because of pre-existing conditions. The insurance company right. can't just cut you off for bullshit reasons. Things like right. that.
Like you're so, a woman.
And those are the things that go in the pro column. And it's basically, it's hard to come up with anything that you can put into the con column that outweighs this. We've expanded coverage. But beyond it, what I think is the other thing in the pro column is the idea that, okay, here's a foundation. I know this sucks, but we're going to be able to build on this, and we're going to be able to construct a real, yeah, it would be better if we had real social insurance where the government was the provider of insurance and everybody had insurance through the government. We can't do that, so we're making you buy insurance from private insurance companies. But look, we're going to, basically, in some subtle way, this is a kind of government takeover of the insurance industry. Just be patient. We're going to transform this into something good. And you see part of that impulse, you know, in the provision of, like, here's this, you know, cost-cutting panel that we're going to try to implement in a way that it's irreversible. Even though, you know, one Congress can't really bind a future Congress in that kind of way. And so I kind of wonder what, I mean, suppose I am an Ezra Klein liberal. I mean, how seriously should I, you know, how much weight should I put in the idea that things are going to get better? Okay, once we have this in place, it's not going to be this giant kludge. Like every single healthcare reform has been, right? We got to this state through a bunch of botched attempts at getting toward single payer. Like they all get the kick always gets blocked, and we end up with some sort of like Frankenstein legislation that each round makes the American healthcare system more and more irrational, right? Why isn't this an example of that? You know, part of that same pattern. Rather than a really solid big move toward the thing that we always wanted. And I think that's an especially good question when you take into account how unpopular this legislation is in the polls, the prospects that that Republicans could regain majorities in the, you know, not distant future. How much should people, a good Ezra Klein liberal, how much should they trust that this really will be the foundation of something that good Ezra Klein liberals want, rather than just a further complexification of the system that is going to be in some ways deconstructed or pushed back or perverted by Republicans, and then we end up with this crazy hodgepodge system again.
That's a question for Ezra, but, you know, it leads me to think that someone in that position has to either be, you know, irrational or disingenuous, as far as it goes. Strangely, right now, we can't have any patience at all. Congress is so dysfunctional that we have to take this bill and run with it, because we can't do any better. Not only is there a crisis so profound that anyone who opposes this bill, whether it's Howard Dean or you or me or you know, Marcos the Republicans in Congress, they must hate Americans and want them to die, right? Because they're opposing this bill. Mm-hmm. The crisis is so profound that anyone who rejects its existence wants Americans to die. Congress is so dysfunctional that we have to take this bill and run with it. And there's no basis for any sort of patience when it comes to letting this legislative process, you know, take two steps forward and one step back. throw up this bill, shoot it down, develop a new one, right? All that goes out the window. Yet, the whole premise that you know, is sort of repackaged for people like you and me to swallow this bill is, it's not perfect, but once it goes through, then, you know, be patient, let the legislature do its job, let it work itself out, these provisions won't kick in until 2014 anyway, right? All of these sort of details that you think would undermine the very, you know, point, the very sort of suite of points that go into the rhetorical push for this bill, they just don't pan out. It's these provisions won't kick in until 2014, and there are these religious exemptions for the penalties that are to be imposed upon people that won't get insurance. You know, you're going to get a lot of religious objectors. It's going to be like the draft. People just won't go. There's going to be mass civil disobedience if these sorts of heavy levies and taxes are going to be imposed. I can't think of any bill, really, in American history. You know, granted, I haven't sat down and thought about it for 24 hours, but when was the last time there's been a bill of this magnitude, with this sort of level of import when it comes to sort of big picture questions about the constitutional makeup of this country, with this sort of price tag on it? When has there been a bill? Did I lose you? Yes, I did. Let's call you back. Bad radio.
Hello.
Hey. Looks like
we lost each other there for a second.
Verizon decided that I was ranting for too long. Long story short, when was the last time, if at all, that there was a bill this intense in sort of its size, its scope, its cost, and its impact on our form of governance, that was so thoroughly opposed by one party, one of two parties, and had such high popular negatives? I just don't think there was one. And liberals, especially Ezra Klein liberals, right, who are, I think, taking the irresponsible, to say the least, road in accusing anyone who opposes this bill right now of wanting Americans to die, Joe Lieberman style. I don't know. I think that they need to provide some sort of answer to that.
I think there's some kind of paradox here, James. As far as how the politics of it works, because Obama, so people say he needs to get this through. If the Democrats failed and if Obama failed to pass this legislation, it would be a huge blow to them politically. On the other side, they're like to pass it. It seems like Democrats want to claim this as a giant victory, as this enormous legislation of immense consequence that finally takes a giant step forward toward ensuring that all Americans have access to decent health care. But the bigger you make the success, the more it begs the question of why was the debate truncated? Why was this passed so hastily in the face of such bad, public opinion? And so it seems like at some level, like, it's going to have to be minimized, that it's not really that big of a deal. You know what I'm saying? Like, if it is a big deal,
which is going to benefit, you know, Republicans more, whether this bill goes down in flames, which now seems unlikely, or whether it succeeds. If there was ever a beast that would be capable of bringing together an increasingly fractured right, you know, libertarians, Tea Partiers, Paulistas, neocons, paleocons, sort of establishment Republicans. This is it. Everyone who isn't sort of in the other corner politically, on a partisan basis, has a reason
to hate this bill. Very principled progressives.
Correct. Yes. As anyone who's watched MSNBC lately can attest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'll be fascinated to see how it pans out because like at some level I know the Republicans like the talking point that it's going to be a big electoral liability. I can see how it could be, but I'll be interested to see how the White House and how congressional Democrats frame it, because the bigger they blow it up, the more they're asking for that backlash. So I want to see how they're going to try to get credit for it while sort of minimizing how big it is. Anyway, I think our time is up, but it seems pretty clear, no matter anything we say, that this is going to be our Christmas present. So Merry Christmas, James.
Enjoy your stocking of coal, Will.
I've been a very good boy. Yes. Merry Christmas, James, and to all of you out there at Blogging Heads who might have hated everything that James and I just said. I really wish you a Merry Christmas anyway, and a Happy New Year, and you know, whatever all the other holidays are, Kwanzaa,
yes,
so forth.
Choose your own adventure this holiday season.
Mm-hmm. We were going to talk about how the war on Christmas has disappeared, which I'm kind of disappointed with, because I was sort of pro-war on Christmas.
If I had 10 seconds on it, my completely unscientific but nonetheless actually empirical observation is, this year people seem a lot more relaxed and comfortable and quicker with the Merry Christmas. So maybe the war on Christmas was a failure. I don't know. It seems like people were more touchy.
I think the war on Christmas is in retreat. Yeah, so I'm going to say to you pointedly, James, happy holidays.
Season's greetings to you, my friend.
All right. Take care and have a good one.
You too.